On the Record on News Talk.
Brought to you by PwC. Great minds think unalike. Different skill sets, diverse opinions, it all adds up. The new equation.
I'm joined by Philip Ryan, the political editor of the Irish and Sunday Independent, and also by Aoife Moore, political correspondent with the Irish Examiner, journalist of the year at the 2021 News Brand's Newspaper Awards. Congratulations to Aoife.
Thank you very
sort
much.
Of feel like we should have like a gold plated chair for you to sit in for the morning. What do you make of David Cullinan's argument that yes, it's, you know, we shouldn't be in the position that we are, but now we are where we are, so we have to do whatever the public health advice says?
Yeah, I don't think anybody wants to see a repeat of the meaningful Christmas, and I think government knows that. I think we all know from working in there that they're incredibly burned by last Christmas. Mm. It took them, a lot of them, a lot longer than it should have to admit that they were wrong, but they have now admitted that they were wrong. So I think, yeah, I think, and from what the polls show as well, that the public are behind it for the majority of the time, that they think they are, more restrictions are needed. You know, we know what the ICU numbers and stuff are like, and it is heading into Christmas and there is no socialisation. But I think I agree with David Cullinan that, and I have said this to the Taoiseach a number of times, there is never any contingency planning whatsoever. It's very much flying by the seat of their pants all the time. There is no looking down the road. It's always in the here and now. We're nearly 2 years into this pandemic, so, and I really feel
you'd like to see them looking at like hypothetical outcomes.
Yes.
And are already starting to plan for them.
Yeah, we know that there's going to be new variants. We know that, like, we've been told this by the WHO and everyone else, there's going to be new variants, there's going to be different factors that we're going to need to look at, and I just don't know why everything is in the next 24 hours. It always feels like this government is just putting out that day's fire, but there never seems to be any further thought on it.
Philip Ryan, just before I go to a break, because there's lots to get through and I want to try and get an outbreak out of the way early on, but do you think that the government has made some of its decisions this week, and even though it hasn't been said and it's not been reported on much, that they're doing it with one eye back on last Christmas and not wanting to be burned by allowing a new variant to run riot before they realise how bad it could be?
Like, everything is through that prism, I think, from last Christmas, that they've had a situation. It was probably the first time that they did in the pandemic. They said, look, we're going to take Enfield's advice, we're going to look at it, we're going to consider it. And you'll remember that they did their EY research gave them.
Remember Stephen Donnelly sitting in the chair that you are right now, saying that it was the right thing to do to close pubs for October and November.
This is it. And they had this other advice which they use. We haven't heard from EY on the pandemic since, but they used that. And they're burnt by that. It didn't work out. So they're in this invidious position where they can't really go against public health advice. It doesn't matter what they say, they have to do it.
What do you make then of Leo Varadkar still allowing it to sort of be known that he is uneasy with the advice that he himself signed off on by telling the Business Post that the decision that he reached is peculiar?
I don't think he's the only person in Cabinet. I think there's actually a majority of people in Cabinet who are going, do we really have to do this? And they know that they're only doing it because it's been presented to them. And if they had their way, there would be more a nuanced approach to it. It'd be the public health advice would be kind of almost developed within government and then presented as the public health advice. But that just not how it's working out.
Well, sorry, go on, Aoife.
Not to be too cynical, but I would also point out that it was in the mouth of Christmas last year when Leo Varadkar went on his rant against Neffitt and Dr. Tony Holohan. And I would say that maybe, you know, politically it doesn't look great to go on to Christmas telling everyone that they need to stay at home and reduce their contacts. And I think that might be part of it too.
Yeah, I wonder. So I wonder what both of you think about whether any of the government feels like it was bounced into its decisions this week by some of it being leaked out, and question marks about whether that came from Neffitt and whether they should be gagged.
On the Record with Gavin Riley on News Talk.
I see John Lee, the group political editor of the DMG Group, which publishes the Irish Mail and Mail on Sunday. He's just tweeted the front page of today's Mail on Sunday right this moment with the caption that ministers choose Neffitt as scapegoats, having used them as political cover for nearly 2 years, which I think is a view that a lot of people will have some sympathy for. Some people might think that it's the government only rightfully reimposing its authority over Neffitt. This is, of course, the story, as reported in many of today's papers and in some of yesterday's as well, that the government has officially decided now that all COVID communications are to be handled directly through the Government Information Service. Now, for those of you who don't work in the Dublin 2 media bubble, GIS is basically government buildings as a press service. So what this ultimately means is now that if a member of Neffitt wants to speak to the public or to be grant an interview about the handling of COVID-19 or to offer any public health advice, they now don't have the individual prerogative to do it. They need to get the advice and the approval of government buildings before they do it. Now, there'll be several people who will think that this is only right and proper, that the government needs to speak more cohesively, that this is a way to stop there being more confusion around what is advice and what is regulation and what is binding. There'll be a lot of people this morning who will say that this isn't a gagging order on NPHET. I won't go into the full details of it, but suffice to say that there are more than one member of NPHET, possibly listening to the programme this morning, who we know, because we were in touch with them, who were available in principle to speak to us this morning. And when we approached the government seeking the clearance, the permission to be allowed to talk to them, we were told that they were unavailable. So suffice to say that that's the approach which has been taken for the time being. Philip Ryan, what do you make of the idea that ministers are trying to clamp down, and what do you think it is precisely that they're actually trying to achieve by doing this?
I suppose there's two ways of looking at it. Number one, that there has a lot, especially in the last, like, say, month or so, there has been a lot of conflicting messages from the government and NPHET. Like, you could take last week where the government, there was the advice about children not under 12 shouldn't go to indoor settings, pantos, places like that. And the government came out and decided to essentially ignore that advice and go like, look, maybe you shouldn't do it, shouldn't do it. And they made their announcement, that they watered down the advice. They said people can do what they want, make your decisions about your own family. And on the same evening, Dr. Holohan, the chief medical officer, put out a statement saying, you should actually do this. My advice still stands. So there's that conflicting message there.
How does telling members of NPHET that they can't go on programmes like this, or that they can't give interviews, how does that actually counter that in any way? It doesn't really, does it?
Well,
it wouldn't stop Tony Holohan still issuing a public letter, or wouldn't stop him issuing a letter.
No, I think that's part of this regime. So like that
Tony Holohan can no longer write to the parents of primary school pupils.
This is the thing. My understanding of it is that communications like that will now go through GIS. So if your statement is coming out, they'll be able to see it and they go, hold on there, Dr. Holohan, you can take that out and you can copy paste what we've just said into your letter and off you go. And but it is a very risky manoeuvre here, because like you can see in the poll, you've seen the Sunday Independent poll today, people like NPHET. You might be on these programs giving out and whinging about restrictions, but the polling shows people trust Tony Holohan, people trust NPHET, people love restrictions in this country. And the government, if they're going to start targeting an institution which is quite respected and liked, it is a dangerous manoeuvre, I think.
I don't know whether this is actually trying to enforce some sort of messaging discipline, or whether this is perceived as being punishment because the government somehow with a straight face believes that NPHET might be leaky.
Can I just say, this government going after NPHET now about mixed communications is absolutely hilarious. This government's communications has been dire since the day and hour they got together to put this three parties under government. Also, the notion that people in this government are annoyed about leaking is also absolutely hilarious. Well, and I would say that they're only annoyed about leaking when they think it makes them personally look bad. We don't even know if the leaks come from NPHET, and as me and Philip were saying to each other earlier, it's not like your phone goes and it's Mr. Leaker and he's like, here's absolutely everything that's in the letter. That's not how leaking works. You have to pull it together, you have to speak to a number of people to get anything that you're going to put into a story and double check it with a few other people. So it's never the case that there's one person who has printed out the letter and said, okay, I'm going to phone all the journalists on my phone now. That's not how leaking works. And also, we don't even know if the leak came from NPHET. There are plenty of leaky people in Cabinet who also could have put that advice.
How does it work then for people who don't know? Far be it for me to ask you for your playbook about how exactly you get something. But if it doesn't work that somebody just sort of pops you, like gives you a phone call
Mr.
or a text.
Mr. Leaker doesn't just phone up.
Yeah, so how does it work then for people who don't know?
Beg, steal, borrow.
Yeah, the way I say it is I have to be as obnoxious as possible. I'm a Catherine Zapone, positively subtle when it comes to double texting. Like
two blue ticks on everything.
I couldn't believe it when the Catherine Zapone stuff came out. People were like, oh, I'm so embarrassed she double texted. I was like, geez, you want to see my text message? I'm like 16 in a row with no reply.
You'd want to look back and see all the deliverance on iMessage or the two blue ticks
that don't
get responded
to. I've been left on two blue texts by hundreds of people. But we know, when NPHET meetings are on and cabinet meetings are on, you just hit the phones and you phone everybody until you get an answer. And then if one person says something, you can't put that in the paper. You have to go and check with another person who was also there if that's correct. So I think this notion, it actually kind of worries me now that the government are going to say to NPHET, well, we need to see what you're putting out before you put it out, because if it doesn't marry with our line, I think that's quite worrying. I think we all should be a bit worried about that. And I also think, Yeah, I just think it's a bit rich for this government to be given off about bad communications when they are who
well,
they are.
It certainly did strike me that, you know, this is a three-party government, so there's three offices of three-party leaders. They all have fairly large courts of advisors and handlers and people who are inside their inner circles and press secretaries and so on. And then you've got 12 other members of cabinet, all of whom have some advisors as well. Now, they're not all brought into the loop at the same time, fair enough. But you have a Minister for Health and a Taoiseach and a Taoiseach and a Leader of the Green Party and probably a Minister for Finance and a Minister for Public Expenditure, maybe a Minister for Justice, maybe a Minister for Social Protection that need to be brought into the loop on a lot of stuff before it gets officially signed off. Mm-hmm. It's a very large circle of courtiers, Philip, and the idea that then politicians are looking at a cadre of civil servants, most of whom could walk anonymously down the street and suspect that they're the ones who are contacting journalists.
A lot of the problem for the politicians is that they want to know first as well. And you can understand that. They don't want to be, Pascal Donoghue or Michael McGrath doesn't want to be sitting in their office or wherever they are and reading about information they should know first on Twitter or on social media. Like, and that is the issue for them, I think, that they want to know first. And then on top of that is the age-old thing with politics and politicians. They want to control the message. They want to be the ones who put it out, and they want to put it out the way they want it out. Mm. And that is a big part of the thing. But how is
what was done this week telling NPHET members that they can't go on the media without permission? How does that change that?
Because
like, it's not, if you tell people that they can't talk publicly, you're not banning leaking.
I actually believe the leaking might get worse.
Yeah, it's a good argument because if they feel like they can't talk publicly, they might be more inclined.
But we shouldn't talk about leaking as if it's a dirty word.
I'm conscious that we're three political journalists in the room, and obviously we're not going to criticise leaking, obviously, because that's our currency.
And it's about giving people information. It's people that the information they need. Like, the stuff leaked from the NPHET, it got out there. It's now the de facto rules, guidance, whatever you want to call it. So, and it's just informing people. It's like, they need a new word for leaking.
I would also say that if NPHET, the people in NPHET, feel that they are being used as cover, political cover, for decisions that are being made and they can't publicly speak to the media, of course, the natural human reaction is they're going to go to journalists and say, actually, that's not the way it is.
The funny thing as well is that even deciding that NPHET members can't go on programmes like this or can't give interviews to RT News or to Virgin Media News, or they can't sit down with either of your newspapers or anyone else, I don't understand how it actually changes the procedure, because there would always be, and there's talk about, Tony Houlihan's letter being leaked. Like, the CMO's letter summarising NPHET's advice is always published just after Cabinet anyway, but there was an instance 10 days ago where it emerged, albeit via a leak, that Tony Houlihan was advising that under-12s basically cut out all socialising in indoor places outside of school. And the government might complain about mixed messages, but the government published the letter on Friday itself. Like, Tony Houlihan didn't send a letter to the editor of the Irish Times and go, by the way, here's my advice. The government published it on a Friday and then allowed it to go until the following Tuesday before the government itself decided whether that was going to be officially endorsed. And then it kind of watered it down. So you had a full weekend where people didn't know, is my daughter's swimming class going to be going on? Yeah. Will arts and crafts thing, or whatever they go to, will the scouts still be happening this weekend? And people not knowing because they didn't know whether there's a week or not. Nothing to do with leaking.
And then this week they decided to inject some drama into the whole thing by getting the information, calling a subcommittee of the Cabinet COVID subcommittee the next morning, then a committee meeting to introduce what we were told is going to be, you know, all this big new restrictions. When the restrictions announced this week are not really if you were a nightclub owner from a family of 12 that had a big Christmas planned, this is going to impact on you quite severely. If you're if you own a hospitality business,
that's not a little unsympathetic for someone who's basically just lost their business season.
Sorry, that's what I'm saying. Like, if you're in the hospitality sector, these are big, this is big restrictions. But I mean, for the vast public, as far as restrictions go, these aren't like the most severe that we've had throughout the pandemic.
Aoife, your thoughts on the restrictions themselves that were introduced a couple of days ago?
I think the nightlife sector has been for the last few years and continues to be treated with absolute disrespect. I think the government were very slow and were bounced into the fact that they needed to bring in better supports, whether it be the PUP or the EWSS. That row is still ongoing. I also think that the public, and we see it from the polling, believe that there is, a need for more restrictions as we head into Christmas. So I think I totally understand the reasons why they're doing it with the new variant and everything else. I just wish there was more thought for people's livelihoods and workers, because they do not seem to. I think they think about these restrictions in the abstract and they give very little thought to the after the afterthought then is, oh, what are we going to do about the people who lose their jobs?
Philip, on a separate note, because there's some opinion polling about whether people support the restrictions or not, and it is quite interesting, by the way, that in the Mail on Sunday, those in the younger age groups are predominantly likely to oppose the restrictions, and then those when you get from 35 upwards or 45 upwards tend to support what's there. But your paper, the Sunday Independent today, also has some polling about public attitudes towards the unvaccinated and whether there ought to be targeted restrictions on them, similar to what's been done in some other countries. Tell us more.
So look, there's a groundswell of support. I think it's 56% think people who are unvaccinated should face further restrictions on how they go about their lives, which I think is the case anyway, because if you're unvaccinated, you can't go to a pub or restaurant and sit indoors. I think from this week, you won't be able to go to a gym. You won't be able to go to go for a meal in a hotel. I think you can actually go to a hotel. So like those restrictions are there already. I think if we're going to go down the route of what Ursula von der Leyen, the European Commission president, said this week about mandatory vaccine, I think we're getting into pretty dangerous territory there. Like we are dealing with someone's, you know, right to their to make their choices about what goes into their body, and
people which is an established human right as defined by the courts.
This is the thing, and like, look, there's people out there who obviously, like, there's the conspiracy side of things where people have their views and maybe influenced by social media and things they read online, and then there's people that probably have a reason for it, you know, like probably have whatever their personal choice is, going like, I don't want to do it. There's this issue with like a lot of pregnant women.
Yeah.
And then the public health advice would say, get the vaccine and do it. But like, you can understand with someone who possibly is having a child going like, I really don't want to risk it because...
You can see where like pregnant people are coming from as well. Like, you're not allowed to drink coffee or eat eggs, but then they're asking you to get this vaccine that we don't actually, we know quite a lot about, but a very new vaccine.
And you have
no
classical literature about what happens 12 or 24 or 36 months afterwards. I'm going to do a quick poll. I'm about to go to a commercial break. If you go to my Twitter, twitter.com/GavinReilly, /GavReilly even, and on the record NT is the hashtag. I want to ask listeners if they do support the government decision that now all COVID communications, which include interviews and statements by NPHET, will need central government approval. Go to twitter.com/GavReilly or on the record NT. You can ask for your thoughts. It's only a 4-minute poll, so we're going to have the results when we're back.
On the record with Gavin Reilly on News Talk.
Do you support the government decision that all COVID communications, including interviews and statements by NPHET, now needing central approval? twitter.com/GavReilly. About 1 minute left to vote on that before the electronic window closes. Ronan has been in touch on 53106. He says, from someone who works in the leisure sector, I can assure you that NPHET's contradictions with government is devastating for our business. From a non-media perspective, this makes total sense. You just don't like, you won't get your interviews, from Ronan, which is a reasonable perspective, and I'm sure it is very, very disconcerting for those in some industries who are going to suffer on the basis of advice, even if it isn't the official government stance. Mary has been in touch. She says, I have to say, something needs to be done to streamline communications. It makes sense for the public and for business. Someone else called H texts in to say that restrictions are all about managing the health system, yet a significant percentage of hospitalizations and ICU beds are unvaccinated people. The whole population is being held to ransom as a result, which maybe, I think, Philip, probably goes back to strikes back to the point you were making about your front page poll there, where people actually think that maybe the unvaccinated need to be given a little bit more stick and a little less carrot to try and push them over the line.
Yeah,
but you get the feeling though at this point they're surely not going to change their minds if they've been defiant up till now. Like,
this is the
very
thing,
little's going to change their minds.
But then there was figures, I think it was last week or the week before, where they were talking about 10,000 people had come forward in 1 week who hadn't been vaccinated before. So I think, and like, even when you're going to do gyms, there's going to be a lot of people. The gyms one is actually a very interesting one, because a lot of people who are into healthcare are into the, you know, looking after themselves. Like, there would be a bit of hesitancy amongst that group about, you know, like they've spent so much time on their body and putting.
We've seen among professional athletes where a lot of them are worried about adverse consequences,
particularly
if you are literally like a sports player of some sort, that you're worried that consequences might knock you out for a couple
this
of weeks.
This is the thing, like, so that's going to have an interesting effect, and you might see a little that group of people either taking them up or in this country, you're not going to have protests, but you'll have people giving out about it.
I think the interesting
point, though, one of your the listeners made about the fact that the difference between the messaging has out there, because I think the big one, especially for hospitality, has been around, you know, these Christmas parties. The government never came out and said people shouldn't have Christmas parties. There was no
I suppose they said that you shouldn't be in the office. So, as if you're not supposed to be in the office with your colleagues, you're probably not supposed to be in a hotel with them either.
Of course. But I mean, there was never advice, and people have taken it on themselves. Mm. And that's really, like, they'd be big parties that would have made a lot of
money. The official advice, Aoife, was not to go to a nightclub three nights a week, wasn't it?
Oh, Stephen Donnelly told you that. What I find incredibly frustrating, and I think a lot of people do too, anytime you ask the Taoiseach or Tánaiste or anybody about this, the Taoiseach always just says, well, anecdotally, I have heard that people, you know, have cancelled their office parties and, you know, that's encouraging or whatever else. Like,
you can't do that unless you work in a restaurant. You can't do that to the pub sector.
You can't do that to the hospitality sector and say, we're not going to give official advice between people not going to parties, but also don't go to parties. And also, you're not going to get any more subsidies or grants if your business is only operating at 30% of what it would be over Christmas.
But I think we have moved into, and I suppose they flagged it to us during the summer as well, that they are trying to have this section of the pandemic about personal choice, that they will set out things here. You're not going to have guards stopping you. You're not going to have people knocking on your home, questioning how many households you have. But you're asked, let's say, to go, look, this is the advice. It's safer if you don't do this, that, and the other. So maybe don't go ahead with it. Like, there's nothing stopping us organising a big Christmas party. We could book out the Shelburne there and have 100 people in it. I don't think there's any rules against that. And
if you're booking a party for more than 6 people, then you'd have to be at one table and there'd have to be only 6 people at it.
Ahead of Tuesday.
Ahead of Tuesday, right. We'll all be there tomorrow night then, we'll
be
there
too. Maybe if we said we were getting married, Philip, we might let us do it.
1,261 of you voted in our Twitter poll. Thank you all very much for all of you who did engage. Do you support the government decision that all COVID communications, including NPHET interviews, now need central approval? Yes, 41.9%. No, 43.9%. 1 in 4 of you, or 1 in 7 of you, were so indecisive that you just wanted to see the results without actually voting. There's one person who gets back and says it's not a binary question. They would just like to see consistent, clear communications from government in general, which I think is a fair point. But I suppose the issue with needing clear, consistent communications is that if the government decides to depart from what the public health advice is, as it's entitled to do for whatever reason, whether it's commercial or whether they just don't believe that it's on the right rationale, or whether they have concerns about the modelling, they're completely entitled to do that. But I suppose we just won't know how they're departing if we don't get to hear from NPHET members in the first place. But I want to draw a line under that, because I'm sure we'll be talking more about it with Pascal Donoghue, who's with us. Aoife, one last comment.
Can I just say that the operative word in public health advice is public, and it's quite worrying that it's not going to be as public as it used to be.
Very fair argument. There are a few other interesting strands in today's newspapers, and Aoife, I wanted to come to you on some of them. There's obviously last week's Business Post poll about whether people were prepared to tolerate the idea of a new national anthem or a new flag in the event of a United Ireland. And there's a big question, of course, the age-old chestnut about whether people would pay more taxes. And there's a piece today by Brian Keegan who's sounding that out again, that a solidarity levy would be one of many new costs.
The last time I was on the show, you made me talk about a United Ireland as well. I feel like I'm your token northerner. I have to come on and talk.
Token journalist of the year there, sorry. But I mean, like, you must find it then, well, on that point, you must find it then very tiresome that whenever there is a debate about unity, it's not about, you know, it's not about actual unity, or it's not about hands across the border. It's about what's it going to cost me, lads.
It's not even that. What I find incredibly boring and incredibly tiring is the amount of time and column inches wasted in talking about flags and anthems when that is not what people are going to care about when it comes down to it. I lived in Scotland during the independence referendum and covered it very closely, and what people really care about is tax and pensions and healthcare and jobs, and that's what we should be talking about. I think all this notion about arguing about flags and anthems is gravy compared to what we should actually be talking about.
What did you make then about this week about that long awaited commission and all of those things coming back with the report that I think was 6 years in the making, and then coming back and going, these are very difficult and we think the executive should decide?
For your
that's
listeners,
a very, very long word
for your listeners who weren't aware, this is the most northern thing I've ever heard, but the executive paid £800,000 for a committee to talk about flags, and they came back with a report saying that they couldn't make a decision on flags. You would have to laugh because you would cry otherwise. But I just think all this, especially in the Republic, obsessed with this flags and anthems, and would you give up the tricolour, would you give up around the vein and everything else? Why don't we have an actual discussion about whether, if there was a United Ireland, would it be the NHS, would it be a Sláintecare, how would that work, what would you do with the civil service? There's a massive civil service in the north. what are you going to do with all those workers? There's a lot more that we need to be talking about now than anthems and flags.
Who should put together some sort of document on that? Because we had this debate last week when we were discussing the poll and saying, you know, the Irish government would almost be argued that it was destabilising things by trying to draw up too many tangible plans in advance.
Well, this is what I also don't understand. There's a massive contradiction because the British government gets to actively, you know, encourage for the union and fight for the union, but if the Republic says that they're in favour of United Ireland, then they're somehow being contentious. That's ridiculous and hypocritical. So I think we know that the British government is supposed to be a neutral arbiter, but they're not. When it came to Brexit and everything else, and when it comes to the union, of course they're going to support the union, but I don't think it is in any way fair to say, well, if the Irish Republic draws up a white paper on how United Ireland would work, that's somehow not allowed.
Philip, then, are you surprised, given all of that, that if there might be a fairly good, rational, sound argument for the Irish government, at least planning for what many people seem to think is inevitable, that shouldn't they be going about it a little bit more proactively instead of having a shared island unit, which is about fostering dialogue but not actually putting anything on the table?
I think the shared island unit is a good initiative, really, because that's kind of where we're at. The thing is, there's all this talk about United Ireland, and John, there's almost this presumption now, if you vote Sinn Féin at the government, north and south like that, you'll suddenly get a border poll. But we don't know what the metrics are for having a border poll. That's not even set out yet. We know that
we don't even know who's allowed to vote.
We don't know who's allowed to vote.
Is it all over 16? Is it all over 18? Do you need citizenship? Or, like, do immigrant communities also get a vote? Like, it's all over the place.
We are so far away from a border poll. It's ridiculous having these conversations because we don't even know what triggers a border poll.
Yeah.
We don't know. There's no metrics. There's no indicators of what happens. There was a court case in London last year trying to set out what they would be.
Yeah.
And that went nowhere. And it's just...
I would also make the point, though, and it's actually in the column in the Business Post today about it, that if there was a Sinn Féin government in the north and Sinn Féin in Dublin, it would be an incredible, I think the phrase in the Business Post column was an incredible marker of bad faith on behalf of London if they wouldn't allow a border poll, as if, you know, London doesn't operate in bad faith most of the time anyway.
Sinn Féin's like, great.
Sinn Féin experts, we have to give
Sinn Féin's already in government in the north, so what difference would it make? But if the voters of the 26 counties,
if they get a majority in the north, if Michelle O'Neill becomes First Minister, Mary Lou McDonald becomes the Taoiseach,
Michelle O'Neill, based on current rates, is going to become First Minister in a couple of months anyway, but it doesn't mean that the tectonic plates have shifted all that much. It just means that unionism is fractured.
No, but they can go back to London and say, well, our ultimate goal as a party, and we're very public about it, is that we want a united Ireland, and the voters in the north and the voters in the south have chosen that. So it's up to London now to decide or to...
They need to set down the parameters. What triggers the poll? Like, is it a majority in the assembly?
Polling.
And is it based on polling? Is it based on a series of elections? Like, is it three assembly elections that show Sinn Féin have, or nationalist parties have, or...
Yeah.
There just needs to be something set out where people and the public actually have an idea of how this transpires, and then they can make the decision themselves, because then that will affect how you vote in an election, because more people go, well, I'd like United Ireland, I'd be more likely to vote, but we're just operating in a vacuum.
We will, by the way, I should mention, in about 40 minutes time, Donald Fallon will be along for Hidden Histories, and I know this week he's intending to talk about the treaty, so in case we were worried about the origins of this state in the first place, but he's talking about the propaganda war that was waged, and actually how Britain, for all of its imperial might and all of its power and all of its influence, that actually the Irish, from a PR perspective, completely ran rings around them, which I know is a fascinating one. Before we go on, I hate to go back to COVID stuff, because I know people are sick to death of it. Aoife, there's a lot of feedback this morning, text machine and on tweets, from people in the arts sector, and you mentioned the nightclub, but people in the arts who are just completely at their wits' end now, being told effectively overnight that they're going to have to reduce to 50% capacity, but they've already sold out the tickets for all their gigs, not knowing really what they're supposed to do, and ending up then having to cancel events which are, specifically speaking, actually allowed.
Yeah, I have nothing to say.
Great, thank you.
No, I think my heart absolutely goes out to them. I think they have been treated with absolute disregard for the last 2 years. I think their jobs and their skills have been seen as quite disposable or something. For a country who kind of markets itself on songs and stories, doesn't seem that arsed about them when it comes to, you know, the sectors and the supports that they need. I think, you know, we saw Heather Humphreys coming out and saying, well, if you've lost a job in a nightclub, go get a job in a cafe. I just think there's a serious level of disrespect. I don't think the government really get it. And I think all the things that makes Ireland interesting and different are slowly, you know, are being eradicated, because people will give up and people will move to London or Berlin or Lisbon or wherever it is, because the sector is just not getting the support and it's getting too hard to work in the arts in Ireland.
Philip, I wonder, is it something of an admission of wrongness that last week when the government implemented the 12 o'clock curfew for nightclubs, that the government, or at least some parts of government, were like, oh, no, this isn't a closure. It's only an early closing time. And now they've sort of acknowledged that actually a lot of those people are going to have to be given the PUP anyway.
Yeah, well, that was kind of a farcical move. And look, you have to give respect to the nightclubs who decided to open at 6 p.m. in the afternoon to try and encourage people. And I believe there was long queues outside some of the nightclubs last night.
I made a rave last week that started at 7.
Yeah.
So it's a very efficient way to get all your partying done, though.
I know, but if you're in your bed for 3, you're like, maybe this is the way to do it.
A couple of text and tweets before we finish. Someone says that, why should an advisory body, this is obviously an effort, be behaving like they run the country? Their job is to advise the government, no role for them to be engaging with the media. Once their advice is made public in the form of a letter, people can discern themselves as to what extent the government should follow their advice, which is a reasonable argument. But
can I just say that there is, I think, sometimes a massive confusion about NPHET. I don't think in any way NPHET act like they run the country. They meet up and write a letter to the government. That letter gets leaked or published by the government. Yeah. And it is
not like
Dr. Tony Houlihan is standing outside government buildings saying, right, everybody out of the pub.
Is this the other thing, though, is that the role of the chief medical officer, even aside from a pandemic, is to issue public health advice. The public health advice is that people shouldn't consume more than 20-something units of alcohol in a week. There aren't rules against it, but they just advise you not to do it.
We don't pay that much attention to that.
The advice is against smoking or vaping or everything else, but it's advice. And if the chief medical officer can't issue advice to the public, then it's a big question. We'll talk about that with Pascal Donoghue. But for now, Aoife Moore, Philip Ryan, thank you both very much for coming in.